From St. Mary's University of Minnesota, you're listening to St. Mary's Currents. I'm your host, Ashley Beeson.
That's a potential for 200 plus acres in the next 20 minutes. We have a potential for structures being threatened in the next 20 minutes.
We're here in Pacific Palisades in Southern California as multiple wildfires burn at this hour, out of control across Los Angeles.
Earlier this year, the fires in Los Angeles, California, caused billions of dollars in property damage and displaced over 100,000 people.
We're keeping a close eye on those wildfires burning out of control in the Northland.
Minnesota had three wildfires, which burned nearly 20,000 acres of northeastern Minnesota in May.
Fire crews this morning say they are now managing the fires as one complex. The Camp House fire has destroyed at least 140 structures, including several homes. Local, state, and federal teams are all working together to try to keep those flames from spreading further.
In June, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, there were active fires in 11 states and in virtually every province in Canada. And now this month, two wildfires have erupted in Grand Canyon National Park.
Arizona firefighters are trying to contain two wildfires that have forced hundreds of tourists from the north rim of the Grand Canyon and burned a historic lodge. The largest fire has now burned more than 50,000 acres.
So, what factors are contributing to the frequency and intensity of wildfires that we're seeing? How can wildfires be prevented or controlled? And what are the long-term impacts on communities and ecosystems? Andy, thank you so much for joining us again. We had you on back in 2022 to discuss climate change, and we're very excited to chat with you today about wildfires. But before we begin, would you mind introducing yourself again and letting our listeners know what you do at St. Mary's, your professional background, and your academic interests?
Great. Thanks, Ashley. It's always a pleasure to be back talking to you. My professional background is in forestry. My educational background is in forestry and ecology and environmental management. I went to school at my undergraduate level for environmental science and ecology and the graduate level for forest management, both of those in Canada because I'm a U.S. citizen and a Canadian citizen. So I've worked in wildfire and the wildfire industry before as a wildland firefighter. I don't do any of that anymore, but wildfire is still a current issue for me. My current position at St. Mary's is as Executive Director of Geospatial Services, and we are a project center within the university that provides experiential learning opportunities for students as they're pursuing their academics here, they're working for us, and pursuing their professional careers at the same time. So it's a real nice marriage of what they're learning here in school and then how they take that into the work environment.
Great. Thank you. So the wildland-urban interface, or WUI, is a growing concern, especially in places like California, where homes and businesses are increasingly built in fire-prone areas. What is the WUI, and what makes it such a challenging factor in the prevention and mitigation of wildfires?
The first thing that everybody needs to understand is that fire has always been a landscape-making initiative across North America. So fire is a part of our landscape. Most of the ecoregions across the country experience some level of fire in their formation. And indeed, in many of those landscapes, plants and animals are adapted to a fire landscape, a fire regime. Okay. For example, there are specific plants that will not open their seed pods unless they're burned. And so have no opportunity to regenerate if there's no fire. Uh-huh. So fire is not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's a mechanism on the landscape. Where it becomes a challenge is where we as a human population start to interact and manage fire. Everybody loves to live in the trees. You know, what's the first thing you do when you move into a new house? You landscape, whether you're living in a city or whether you're living in the country. Mm-hmm. Many people move to rural settings because of the vegetation surrounding their properties. It gives them privacy. It gives them comfort. It also burns. So we all need to be aware of the fact that fire is a part of our landscape and that it impacts directly and indirectly on us all the time. The wildland-urban interface is a really critical juncture of those elements. People want to live where there is a natural surrounding. Mm-hmm. They want to live adjacent to properties that are not developed. But those are the portions of the landscape that are most at risk from wildfire. The areas that are not controlled, the areas that don't have a water source for fire extinguishment, the ones that have fuel sources. We want to be near them, but at the same time, we have to recognize the hazard that that creates. The additional thing is that we're bringing our own lives into those environments as well. So if you develop a subdivision inside a forest, all of a sudden you're exposing that forest to ignition sources. Could be sparks coming from a fire pit. It could be something that gets thrown out or not extinguished properly. There's any number of ways that we introduce ignition sources into those natural environments that then exacerbate the challenge.
So what are some differences we're seeing in like the causes and mitigation strategies between, say, fires in Canada in comparison with fires that we're seeing in the U.S., maybe even in Minnesota or in California?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned earlier that I'm Canadian as well as being American. I have citizenship in both countries. And so I have worked and lived in both locations. And we think that Canadian culture and U.S. culture and countries are very, very similar, which they are. There's also some pretty significant differences. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest differences that I note when somebody asks me that question is the private-public land ethic and how that differs between the two countries. Canada is primarily public land.
Okay.
The country doesn't have near the population that the U.S. does. In fact, it's only about a tenth of the population of the United States. There's a lot of land that just isn't occupied, and it isn't in private ownership. Whereas in the United States, almost every parcel of land is privately owned, or there's a population center or at least some sort of development close to it. That affects the wildfire regime and the wildfire management strategy. In many cases in Canada, wildfires are left to burn if they're not impacting on life or property or somebody's livelihood. And that livelihood extends to things like mining and agriculture and forestry as well. So if a forest fire is burning and it's impacting on a standing timber resource of a timber company, of course it's going to get action.
Sure.
But if it's burning in an area that has no impact, it'll quite often be left to burn mm-hmm. and just extinguish itself over time. There's caveats around that, of course. In the United States, everything is adjacent to somebody. Everything is adjacent to private property. Everything is adjacent to an economic interest. And so the wildfire strategy is to hop on it right away. Mm-hmm. Nothing is left to burn. It's get on it right away, put it out as quickly as possible, and minimize the impact of it. Now, one thing that gets missed sometimes in the Canadian strategy is the environmental impact, the atmospheric impact of fire. So if you let a fire burn, and this is a funny anecdote, but I worked on a fire many, many years ago that was burning in a wet forest area and went underground. It burned in the root systems of the forest mm-hmm. and actually came back up again 2 years later. So it was a fire that had started 2 years before, burned underground for 2 years, and then when conditions are right, it sprang back up again. So there are risks. The smoke hazard is another big mm-hmm. thing. Let a fire burn, and all of a sudden you're putting all of those particles into the atmosphere. And as we know, and as we've seen, they travel long distances.
Yep. So we just saw that in Minnesota with the Canadian wildfires, there was a lot of air quality notices that were coming down.
Yep.
So,
you know, as you contemplate what the strategies are for dealing with forest fire, there's lots of differences, there's lots of commonalities, but there's lots of elements you need to consider in terms of its impact on the human environment.
Now, with Canada, you're saying most of their land is public in comparison with the U.S. So how does that factor kind of interplay then with the involvement of government?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a larger role that they play in mitigation with that? Or because there's, you know, less concern by, you know, the general public because it's not necessarily jutting up right against their own personal property? Is there any change with that?
Yeah, there definitely is. And I don't want to minimize the difference, you know, the public-private land difference, because fire travels really quickly in the right conditions. We saw some major impacts in Canada last year where half the town of Jasper, Alberta burnt because of the speed at which the fire in that area was traveling. They thought they had it under control. The winds picked up, the fuels were dried out, and so the fire jumped and moved really quickly. And so you really have to be careful. I mean, if your strategy in public land areas that aren't impacted economically or publicly is to let it burn, you still have to monitor it, and you still have to be ready to respond at a moment's notice if the conditions change. So in Canada, the fire landscape is managed primarily by the federal and provincial governments in combination. Provincial governments have the primary responsibility, but the federal government is also involved in resources, just like they are in the U.S., like aerial bombing resources and individual labor resources are managed as a whole between the provincial and the federal government, just like they are with the municipal governments and the federal government in the United States. So it's very similar. And it's a very militaristic organization. I don't know if you've come across that in your research, but fire crews and fire management is run on a military basis. You know, there are commanders and there are brigades and the structure around it, because you need a level of organization, is very militaristic. And that's the same in Canada as it is in the U.S.
So beyond, you know, the obvious immediate destruction, wildfires have long-term impacts on communities and ecosystems. How does geospatial technology and what you do at GSS help assess and mitigate these broader effects?
So one of the core technologies behind fire management is GIS, Geographic Information Systems technology, which is our expertise at Geospatial Services. The technology is used before the fires even start. So we've been engaged in projects where we're recreating fire histories over long periods of time, hundreds of years, to try and understand ignition points, fuel sources, migration patterns, movement patterns of fire across the landscape. Those are things like recording burn scars on trees, trees that for 200 or 300 years, and you can see examining their rings where they've been exposed to fire and where they haven't been exposed to fire. So you can start to reconstruct from those vegetative communities what the fire history is like. So GIS creates maps of fire history, fire expectation. Then it also creates maps of the current vegetation communities, so the standing fuel resources that would exist if a fire were to ignite, and then maps of environmental conditions, atmospheric conditions, wind patterns. So all of these are precursor tools that are used to examine the landscape to predict where a fire might be. When a fire breaks out, mapping GIS technology is one of the core and most important tools that the incident managers have to assess the current conditions. There's spotters in the air, in aircraft, there's spotters on the ground, there's spotters in fire towers, there's spotters everywhere recording locational information about what fires are doing at any particular point in time. GIS is a locational technology, so all of that information goes into GIS and is used to create incident maps, on-the-ground management maps, mapping products that are used throughout the fire management process. Now that we have things like drones, drones are being used as well for management activity. That data feeds directly into the geographic information system to create immediate plans for how you would attack the burn. Results of aerial bombing, for example, those will get mapped right away. The bombing aircraft now carry technology that gets that mapping into the system right away. And so the maps are now immediate. And then it creates a much more effective response and management tool as you go through the actual fire itself. And then, of course, afterwards, there's all kinds of roles for GIS technology. One of the things that we've been involved in most recently is valuation of destroyed property, you know, using demographic information, real estate information to create maps of where and how significant the damage has been.
Wow.
So there's all kinds of roles for it throughout the entire process of a burn
for
the technology. In 2003, Congress got out ahead of this with the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, which was a very important piece of legislation in that it recognized the importance of fire on the landscape and the impact of wildfires on communities. What it did was it enabled communities to develop and gave the framework for communities to develop community fire management plans.
Okay.
And those are really focused on preparing communities for the advent of wildfire, and not just in the sense of when it's burning, but also what they can do ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So looking at fuel sources, looking at things that they can do around their individual properties to minimize the impact of a fire on their property. For example, there are fire retardant vegetation that you can plant that don't burn nearly as hot or as long or even at all in comparison to other vegetation types that you might plant. So there's planting recommendations. You wouldn't even think of that necessarily, but the Healthy Forest Act brought that into the forefront. Having water barriers. So you create water features on your landscape that fires can burn on the ground, they can burn in the air. anything that creates a barrier for fire migration is a critical management piece of what individual landowners can do. And then you think about the safety aspects of it. Mm-hmm. If you're living in a rural area, making sure that every property and every resource is identified, you know, in the heat of the moment, people are trying to make decisions about what to fight first.
Sure.
So if you know where the houses are, that's one thing. But where are the sheds? Where are the pet kennels? Where are the more we can identify the features that inform the people that are fighting in these really immediate high anxiety situations, the more we can preserve what's left. And then there's movement. So if a fire, Los Angeles brought this to the forefront, people need to get out of where something's burning. If we don't know the escape routes and the best ways to channel that traffic to get people away from the fire, people are at risk. And we need to accommodate not just the location of movement, but the patterns of movement. So even if you've got an escape route identified and all of a sudden it's clogged by 400 people, that doesn't work. And so all that needs to be thought about ahead of the time so that communities are prepared. And that's what these community wildfire plans are designed to do. And there's funding available from the federal government. There's templates available now. People can get out ahead of this if they proactively do it. And so it comes down to community leaders and municipal governments and local governments to make sure that they're aware of the resources and to make those resources available to the folks that need them.
So as climate change continues to alter weather patterns, do you foresee an increase in the duration of wildfire seasons or maybe the areas affected by wildfires? What are some ways that you believe local and state governments can prepare for some of these long-term changes?
So now you're hitting on one of the biggest challenges of all. People talk about climate warming. Warming is just one aspect of the change in climate that we're experiencing right now. Storm intensity is another. And, you know, everybody, I think, is anecdotally aware that thunderstorms, lightning strikes are increasing. They're increasing in frequency and they're increasing in intensity. Lightning strikes are the single largest source of wildfires. Nothing else. Human impact. And it's the single biggest cause. So if we move to a more intense storm landscape with more lightning strikes and lightning strikes in different locations than has ever happened before, we've got to be prepared. I'll give you one small anecdote about that. GSS does a lot of work in the high Arctic in Alaska. The high Arctic in Alaska has always had a pretty stable climate. It's all changing now with drying and with warming. We experienced one of the very first thunderstorms on the Arctic coastal plain when we were up there a couple of years ago. The landscape has always been wet up there, but it's drying out now. Permafrost is melting. There isn't as much standing water on the landscape. Lightning strikes are actually creating tundra fires now because the tundra is dry enough that it ignites in a lightning strike. And that burns across the landscape really quickly, especially if you have wind behind it. So we're experiencing drying, we're experiencing more intensity storms, and we're experiencing high velocity winds behind those storms that are exacerbating the natural fire conditions continuously. So we as managers, collectively, have to understand that that's going to continue to happen, and we have to modify our firefighting behavior in order to adapt to that. I was involved in a fire in Canada about 25 years ago now that started in the spring after a really dry winter, low snow, which we're experiencing now here in Minnesota. Didn't have the moisture on the landscape to keep the grasses wet in early spring before they started growing. So all those grasses are dried out. They're last year's growth. Had a lightning strike and then had 100-mile-an-hour winds behind that lightning strike. And that 100-mile-an-hour wind drove that fire 700,000 acres in 24 hours.
Wow.
How do you defend against that? So really, we have to adapt. We have to continuously adapt to the changing conditions. Vegetation is changing. Rainfall patterns are changing. Storm intensity is changing. Wind patterns are changing. And it's changing where we deploy, how we respond. Now it's a continuous adaptation. So planning ahead of time becomes critically important. We mentioned the fact that these crews are militaristic. They need to be militaristic because they have to communicate quickly and they have to move quickly and we have to deploy. So I think the future is that we need more information up front. GIS comes into play on that, as we discussed earlier. We need to be able to respond quickly and then we need to be able to adapt quickly as conditions change on the ground.
We'll be right back in a minute.
The School of Health and Human Services specializes in nurturing compassionate leaders, equipped with the skills needed today and tomorrow, with a focus on increasing access to services for everyone. Our commitment is to serve you so you can serve others. Discover our undergraduate nursing program on the Winona campus, or demonstrate your expertise and readiness to become a leader with a master's degree in social work, public health, healthcare administration, and more. Our accredited doctoral programs are recognized for their high standards. Our graduates meaningfully contribute to their fields across the world. Start your journey toward becoming a compassionate, empathetic, and ethical leader in health and human services. Join us by visiting smumn.edu. St. Mary's University of Minnesota, because of you.
Once there was a little boy who liked to visit his friends, the trees.
Hello, tree.
Hello, boy.
But there were other people who didn't seem to appreciate the forest. They left campfires burning, and they failed to crush out cigarettes.
Be sure you're never responsible for this terrible destruction. So remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
We've been hearing a lot about wildfires in the news lately, but they're not new. So how have wildfires transformed their environments historically in comparison with now and, say, the Canadian forests, for example? What actually happens after a massive wildfire, and are there steps being taken to regenerate the landscape?
So one of the really interesting things about how fire is changing now is how the landscape responds to fire afterwards. One of the things that we, as I'm going to say recent settlers to this country, don't have the perspective on, though, is that human settlement has existed across North America for thousands of years. Indigenous communities have used fire, controlled fire, and wildfire in their traditional land management practices for thousands of years before European settlers arrived in the United States. In fact, the landscape that European settlers found when they colonized was a landscape formed by fire, by indigenous fire. Fire to grow medicinal plants, fire to encourage migration patterns for wildlife, fire as a cultural practice and a spiritual practice. Every indigenous community across North America practiced fire in some way, shape, or form. There were also wildfires. But the indigenous fire management practices managed fire fairly effectively in that they controlled available fuels that were free to burn naturally. They directed fire in different patterns by using fire breaks and water and all kinds of tools that are very similar to what we would use in fighting fire. And so, you know, there's a lot we can learn from those indigenous fire practices. And there's a 3,000-year history that spans climate changes over those 3,000 years that we can learn from. But climate is changing so rapidly now, and the impacts are so intense that vegetation communities are being destroyed completely in some of the worst wildfires, and then are regenerating to plant species that are adapted to new climate conditions. Invasive species in particular, because when you raise a landscape with fire, you're burning the vegetation on the forest floor, you're burning the vegetation at the mid-level, and you're burning the tops of the trees in the worst of the fires. That creates an environment for what are called pioneer plant species, the first plant species that would occupy a portion of the landscape. And invasive plants are the most unregulated plants that come into those environments afterwards. So our climate's changing. We're getting invasive plants into areas that normally they would not have grown. And now we're creating, through fire, these environments where they can thrive. And so entire vegetation communities are being changed by that. I don't want to overstate it. It's not happening everywhere, but it's a real outcome of fire on the landscape, especially intense fire on the landscape. So we as vegetation and land management. I mentioned the indigenous communities. They were using fire for a specific purpose, to grow specific plants, to encourage specific wildlife. We're wanting to do the same thing, but we need to adapt because the climate variability is creating environments for different plants than grew in these locations historically. You know, pine trees, for example, are standard across Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Pine trees are migrating north because the weather patterns and the climate patterns that we're experiencing in Minnesota are actually what was in Missouri, you know, 50, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. So Missouri's moving into Minnesota. That means that the trees, plants, everything else that thrived in the original Minnesota landscape has to move north where it's cooler. So pine trees are migrating north. So are we going to replant pine trees in a pine area that's burned by a wildfire? Probably not, because they're not going to be successful. So the science comes into it. We need to understand what the appropriate regenerative landscape should be and should look like. And we need to accommodate that as we work to regenerate these landscapes afterwards.
Is that something that GIS and GASS can assist with as well? Some of that kind of pre-planning as far as what other vegetation could go in instead?
100%. And so we're already doing that type of work. And we produced a study probably 10 years ago now called a climate change vulnerability study for the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. It was a GIS and text-based document that talked about exactly what you're asking. What should these landscapes look like? Indigenous knowledge is really critical for that because they've been for thousands of years experiencing landscape change across North America. So in their historical records, there are records of plant communities that thrived previously and no longer do. So yes, mapping technologies and the data associated with mapping is a critical piece of effectively managing what could happen with the landscape.
Now, you mentioned the National Park Service. I know they've stated that nearly 85% of wildland fires in the U.S. are caused by humans. What are some common ways that an accidental fire could start and things that people would be able to do, any small steps that they can take just to make sure to help reduce the likelihood of something like that occurring?
Yeah, so there are lots of things that we might not even think about. You know, inefficient fireplaces are one of the key ignition sources. All of us love to have a backyard grill or a fire pit in the summer. And, you know, in the right conditions, sparks can travel a long distance from those sources or out of your chimney as you're having a wood fire internally. And if you haven't cleaned out that chimney and kept it in its proper condition, sparks and embers can travel a long distance, especially if there's wind behind them, and they can ignite. And so I'd say that those are probably the biggest sources. So burning on properties to control your landscape, fire that you initiate yourself and don't extinguish properly. Cigarette butts are always one that gets pointed to regularly, sparks out of chimneys that where you have creosote buildup inside the chimney and so on. So I think those are kind of the main personal things that you could be aware of.
So the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced plans to rescind a 2001 roadless area conservation rule, which will remove protections on 59 million acres of U.S. national forest. And the argument for this says that the move will open a new era of consistency and sustainability for our nation's forest. Now, according to the Associated Press, scientists say that worsening wildfires are driven by a combination of climate change, which I know you touched on, and basically that it warms out and dries out forests, less logging, decades of fire suppression that's allowed fuels to build up. And I know these are all things that you've mentioned while we've been speaking. So firstly, can you tell me a little bit more about what this roadless rule is? And then, you know, just share a little bit about, you know, what's your take on this decision to rescind it?
We value as a society access to public lands. In many cases in the Western United States where climate conditions are really fire prone. And we value access to those lands because in a lot of the country, land is tied up in private ownership. People love to recreate. Mm-hmm. People love to conduct recreational activities that require large amounts of space. If I want to go hiking for 14 miles and not see another person, am I going to do that in Minnesota? Highly unlikely unless I'm up on the Arrowhead on Lake Superior. But our public lands exist for those activities. Public lands also exist to support wild communities, wildlife. Grizzly bear is kind of the classic example of that, or wolves, where the home range of an individual grizzly bear is 50 square miles. So that bear will range across that land in its daily activities. Well, where is a bear going to find that amount of land in contiguous form that it can access other than through large blocks of public land. I know I'm getting slightly off topic, but there's a variety of reasons to maintain those large blocks of public land. Fire management is another very good reason for that. Access to human populations creates the opportunity for fire, fire ignition. You know, when somebody's out in the woods and they're hiking and they're camping, they want to have a fire. People are doing it regardless of fire bans and everything else right now in these public land areas. The more you open up those lands, the more accessibility there is for that type of thing to happen. And logging is another perfect example. One of the reasons why the administration wants to open up some of these public forest lands is to increase logging too. And it's from a beneficial standpoint. We're trying to create jobs. We're trying to support the forest products industry by providing them with more natural resource. But at the same time, the forest products industry has been one of the major causes of wildfire because they create fuels. You know, what do you want from a tree when you harvest it? You want the lumber. You want the log. The branches are incidental. So the branches get stripped off. They get left on the ground as part of the harvest process. Sometimes they get collected up into piles. Those become ignition sources and fire continuity sources as a fire starts to burn that the fire takes advantage of. And so if we're not deliberate about managing that as we open up these lands to increased human activity, then we're going to worsen the situation. Removing timber also dries out forests because you create more opportunity for winds to circulate within. If you think about selectively taking out individual trees or groups of trees, you create an opportunity for winds to circulate more. That dries out the forest, and it also creates the opportunity when a fire does start for the winds to cause more damage than they would have previously. Fire moves between treetops as well, same type of thing. It'll hop from one tree to another. So, you know, there's a variety of reasons why it creates and continues to create a more dangerous situation when we open up public lands for activity. The Forest Service is not the only one. Bureau of Land Management lands are at risk. National monuments are at risk. There's any number of public land areas that, if they are opened up and accessed in the ways that are being discussed, become a fire risk.
So how does that work in the sense of, I mean, conceptually, I can kind of wrap my head around, okay, if there's a road that I can drive through much of this public land that wasn't there before and there is a fire, there is some increased access to be able to put that fire out because of that access. But on the other end of things, you know, you touched on lightning being a huge factor for starting fires. When you have thousands of acres like that, how are those fires being addressed now because that access doesn't exist?
Yeah, so there are management agencies in the U.S. that have the similar policy to Canada where fires are just left to burn. They're not actioned. The National Park Service has that as part of their policy where life and property is not impacted. But you're right, you know, creating roads in areas that don't currently have roads creates access, and you can start to fireproof using those roads. And so it becomes a juggling act, right?
Sure.
Roadless areas, natural wilderness experience, wilderness available for keystone species like wolves and bears and all the things that we want to see continue on the landscape as humans that are viewing this thing. Mm-hmm. It's a balance. Mm-hmm. So what do you want? What do you want to achieve? Mm-hmm. And I think previously the pendulum swung towards maintenance of large blocks of land purposefully for those purposes. And now it's swinging the other direction. Let's make use of these. What I really am concerned about is those large blocks of public land falling into private ownership, because then the management of them is on an individual or a corporation. The accessibility, it becomes paid for, and we just lose a lot of what we value as our American heritage.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a forester, I'm sure wildfires and environmental concerns can keep you up at night. Are there any recent developments or approaches that specifically give you hope?
So I don't want to sound too negative. I'm very passionate about public lands and this public land issue, and I'm an ecologist. So as a scientist, these large blocks of land and fire as a management tool are very, very important to me. We are creating awareness all the time by doing this. People are becoming aware of not just what they value as individuals, but of the science that's behind what's happening out there. So the more attention that we bring to these issues, the better off we are as a society, because people can mobilize. You know, People can individually manage their fire landscape, their own properties. They can get behind the agencies that are trying their best to mitigate a fire landscape. And as individuals, they can talk to each other and talk to their representatives to make sure that the decisions that are being made on the landscape are decisions that we all agree with. Are we all going to come to common ground? I mean, it's clear that we're a divided country right now, but everybody's still an individual. Everybody has the best interests of America at heart, and everybody is interested in continuing to enjoy the natural resources of our country. So I think wildfire, while it's devastating, is bringing an awareness to us that we've never had before and is mobilizing people to make a difference in this country, which is really exciting to me.
Andy, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
St. Mary's Currents is a production of the St. Mary's University of Minnesota Office of Marketing and Communication. It is produced by Ashley Beeson with help from Michelle Rovang. It is recorded, edited, and engineered by Jeffrey DeMarsh. Our theme music is by Will Van de Kramer. For more information on this episode or St. Mary's Currents, visit smumn.edu/currents. And if you enjoyed this episode, please follow us wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Ashley Beeson. We'll see you next time for St. Mary's Currents.